Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Whether you admire him or despise him, Donald Rumsfeld has been the man at the center of the American war plan for Iraq. At 71 years old and serving his second term as U.S. Defense Secretary, Rumsfeld expresses the self-confidence of an administration that leaves very little room for criticism or questioning, even on such issues as how long U.S. soldiers might remain in Iraq.
Days, weeks, or months? Don't know. Same thing like the cost. If you can't tell how long it's going to last, you sure can't tell what it's going to cost. But now...
Do you believe that Saddam Hussein is still alive?
Don't know.
You believe that he was in that building before it was taken out?
Don't know.
Mr.
General Myers,
yes.
You characterize...
No, no, that's true. You just don't like one-word answers. Yes.
Is there any effort to either unreport or underreport casualties from the battlefield?
Oh, my goodness. Now, you know that wouldn't be the case. There's no one in this government is going to underreport what's happening.
Which is a greater threat, Syria or Iran?
I thought that was the last question. Thanks.
It was the last answer.
But the Rumsfeld star may be showing wear. His repeated insistence that all is well with the U.S. post-war plan in Iraq has now been formally contradicted by President Bush with a shift back to the United Nations for assistance. Connection listeners, is the Rumsfeld era near its end? Should it be? Is the man who put the pit bull face on U.S. diplomacy falling from favor in Washington? Or is it just those who never liked him to begin with who'd like to think that's the case? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. In a couple of moments, we'll chat with the military analyst Andrew Basevich and the law professor Ruth Wedgwood about the defense secretary. First, though, to Washington, Vernon Loeb covers the Defense Department for the Washington Post, and he's joining us from the Post studio. Hi, Vernon.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine. Tell me whether or not, in your view, the Rumsfeld star is starting to fade a little bit here.
Well, I think it's perhaps starting to fade a little bit. You're seeing criticism of Donald Rumsfeld that he hasn't faced since 9/11. But I certainly think it's way too premature to say that his run is possibly coming to an end and that he may be removed from office. This is one tough guy we're dealing with, and he's a very complex figure. So I think Rumsfeld's got a long time to go at the Pentagon.
You know, you're one of those people who covers him on a regular basis. Are you surprised that it's taken this long for Rumsfeld to get in any way tripped up?
Not really. I mean, you look at the campaign in Afghanistan, and it was a stunning success. The major combat phase in Iraq was also rapid, stunning in its own way, in this kind of interesting way they fought it. And I guess I'm a bit surprised that it's taken as long as it has for the post-war problems to come home to roost at the Pentagon. I mean, what we're seeing now is the consequence of Rumsfeld demanding basically all control. He got all control, and thus he also has all responsibility. And now it is finally coming home to roost for him. But Rumsfeld always deals from strength. He never acknowledges weakness publicly. That's just the way he operates. I don't think that's to say that privately he isn't concerned and that privately he's recalculating. He's a very shrewd guy. And I think a lot of people mistake his public confidence with private confidence and arrogance. That's selling this guy way short. He's always recalibrating. He's always mulling ideas and thinking things over. Never underestimate Donald Rumsfeld. That would be my advice from having covered him for 2 years.
He is, though, still telling people who criticize him or the post-war plan that such talk can be seen as unpatriotic, right?
Yes, and I think it was remarkable this week that both Joe Lieberman and John Kerry have basically come out and said that remark was reprehensible. They're really taking Rumsfeld on in a way that, people haven't been willing to take Donald Rumsfeld on since 9/11. You know, Rumsfeld didn't do very well in his first year at the Pentagon. He was really seen as floundering, fighting with the military. And then 9/11 happened, and he really rose to the occasion. And since then, people have basically said the man is a much better war secretary than he is a defense secretary. That, you know, building the kinds of coalitions necessary to change defense policy may not be his forte, but really marshaling the authority to command a war is. And now we're starting to see that change a bit in an interesting way. You know, is he the brilliant war secretary that everyone has been saying he is since 9/11?
And we heard some of those questions as well from Senator Edward Kennedy, who was talking about the defense secretary on NPR's Morning Edition.
He is the designer of the post-war program, as Mr. Wolfowitz. I think they should really step aside now. This is a bankrupt policy. They ought to stand aside. Let Powell go to the United Nations. Let him negotiate a meaningful resolution. And then let's try and get on with the new phase in terms of Iraq. The world community should be involved, and Secretary Powell should have the full authority to do that, and we ought to keep Don Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz out of those negotiations.
Vernon Loeb, any hint at all from the White House that Defense Secretary Rumsfeld may not have the same profile, may not be the voice of that administration in the days and the weeks to come?
Nothing out of the White House directly. I was quite interested in some comments by Bill Kristol, who is the editor of the conservative Weekly Standard and a very influential neocon voice, who told one of our reporters last week that, you know, Rumsfeld has had 5 months to manage the post-war situation in Iraq. He hasn't gotten it together, and now he's really let the White House down. So I thought that was a very interesting remark. Perhaps some sort of signal that confidence in Rumsfeld is waning in the White House. But I haven't seen anything directly from the White House. And quite frankly, I'm skeptical of those who argue that, you know, Rumsfeld is on the way out or the Bush has lost confidence in him. I just haven't seen it yet, and I don't think Rumsfeld's going anywhere.
I mean, he's not, in most senses, a freelancer. What he says and the face that he presents, I always get the impression, is done with the explicit or implicit approval of the Oval Office.
I think that's true. I mean, I think it is quite possible to hold Rumsfeld responsible for far too much. I mean, there are other very, very influential figures in this administration, probably more so than he, beginning with the president and also definitely including Vice President Dick Cheney. Look, Rumsfeld plays the internal game, fights real hard. He believes very strongly in what he believes in. He's no shrinking violet. But at the same time, I've always gotten the impression that he realizes that at the end of the day, it's the president's call. Whether to go to war is the president's call. How to conduct these operations is the president's call. And once the president makes a call, as he has now with the decision to go for a second UN resolution, you know, Rumsfeld, like the military, kind of salutes smartly. Look, I don't think Rumsfeld has any great desire for a second UN resolution right now, but the administration is going forward because the president has made a decision.
Vernon, thanks for being with us.
Sure.
Vernon Loeb is Defense Department reporter with The Washington Post, joining us from his office of studio there. As I mentioned earlier, I have with me on the program today Andrew Bacevich. He's director of the Center for International Relations at Boston University, author of American Empire, The Realities and Consequences of U.S. Diplomacy. We're also joined by telephone from Washington, Ruth Wedgwood. She's a professor of international law and diplomacy at Johns Hopkins University, School of Advanced International Studies. She's also a member of the Defense Policy Board, which gives advice to the Defense Department. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Andrew, let me start with you and pick it up just with what Vernon was saying at the end there. Is any criticism of Donald Rumsfeld at this point legitimate, or should it be criticism of the president?
Certainly there is legitimate criticism. I mean, I'd want to emphasize a couple of points that Vernon Loeb made. And the first is that Rumsfeld has been down before. We have almost forgotten that on September 10th, the day before the terrorist attack, sort of the talk was that Rumsfeld, having failed in his ambitious plans to transform the Pentagon, was going to be the first member of the cabinet to depart. And then that quickly turned around. And it could turn around again if we enjoyed some significant military successes here. That would be point number one. Point number two would be, yes, the responsible officer of this government is not Donald Rumsfeld. It is George W. Bush. And it seems to me that we ought not. It's reasonable to talk about Rumsfeld's miscalculations and failures, but not to the extent of giving the president a bye. If you were sort of conspiracy-minded, you might even say that somebody like Karl Rove, looking at the 2004 election at a time when the war is not going well, might actually be quite happy that we're all beating up on Donald Rumsfeld, because in doing so, implicitly, we give the president a bye, and implicitly that could help the chances of the president being reelected next time out.
All right, Ruth Wedgwood, Andy talks about miscalculations and failures by the defense secretary. Would you agree that those words apply?
I'm not sure that's quite fair, because Don Rumsfeld often says he knows what he doesn't know, and every war has unanticipated consequences or events. For example, when Wes Clark was fighting Kosovo, Madeleine Albright and Wes thought that the Kosovo war would last only several days, a couple of weeks. Nobody thought it would last as long as it did. They were short of targets. So almost every conflict will have surprises, and the question is how well you adapt to those surprises when they occur.
Well, we can talk about the run-up to the war and the execution of the war, but I think probably what sticks in most people's minds right now are those weeks and months after the war, June and July, when Rumsfeld was the voice of the administration saying all is well, and we now know that even the administration has decided all is not that well.
Well, there's turned out to be a rather difficult counterterrorism mission, which, frankly, American troops tend to attract wherever they are in the Middle East. That's something that, again, is solved not so much by brute force, but by trying assiduously to develop intelligence sources, so trying to get smart on who's acting and putting pressure on the neighboring countries to try to close their borders. Counterterrorism's a difficult thing. It's been shown to be difficult in our fight against Al-Qaeda elsewhere. It's not a classical military mission. But I guess for me, the bottom line is not whether there are bumps in the road, but whether you think this is and was a mission worth doing. And even in light of its later costs, displacing Saddam so he couldn't use WMD in the future, I think was well worthwhile, as well as the example of displacing somebody who'd been such a brutal leader toward his own people.
But by taking that great long step back overview, aren't you papering over some of the miscalculations along the way?
Well, I guess the question I put is, what could you have done in advance? One is aware, I think Rumsfeld's aware, of some of the problems we have as a operating force. We don't have 10,000 Arabic speakers. We do have, for example, necessary components such as military police and civil affairs who are in the reserve, so it's very hard on their families when they're deployed for long periods of time. But you can't change those in 6 months or 3 months. It takes them years to build up that kind of force, to restructure the army. So I think when you're fighting a war, you're left to do the best you can with the assets you have at hand, and then you make a decision whether it's worth going or not. Did people expect that Saddam would fade away as he did? No, obviously not. Were there benefits to it? Yes. We didn't lose any soldiers in chemical weapons attacks. We didn't have gross civilian casualties in fighting the war. Clearly it's difficult now, but there are equal costs that we avoided.
All right, Connection listeners, Donald Rumsfeld has been front and center in the American invasion of Iraq, certainly since this first came before the United Nations almost a year ago. What could have been done in advance? It's a question that Ruth Wedgwood puts. We'll pick that up when we come back. We'd also like to hear from you. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. And this hour we're talking about Donald Rumsfeld. For the first time since the September 11th, the events of September 11th, people are raising questions about the abrasive style and the the image that Donald Rumsfeld portrays. We're talking this hour with Andrew Bacevich here in the studio. He's director of the Center for International Relations at Boston University, editor of a new book called The Imperial Tense, Problems and Prospects of American Empire. Ruth Wedgwood is joining us by phone from Washington. She is a professor of international law at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, also a senior fellow on the Council on Foreign Relations. Andrew, back to you with where Ruth left off. What could have been done in advance? Is that a question which, in a way, lets Rumsfeld off the hook?
Well, I think things could have been done differently that would have somewhat alleviated the problems that we have right now. And I don't think this is simply 2020 hindsight. We could have been more patient in pressing the case for war. Being more patient might have gotten a UN resolution. That might have given us greater legitimacy for our post-war presence. It might have given us a greater ability to attract other nations to help foot the bill and perhaps also contribute troops. And there were people who were saying prior to the war that this would have been a wiser course, to the extent that Rumsfeld was in all likelihood among those pressing for war, insisting upon a unilateral approach, then it seems to me that it's quite fair to charge him with some of those difficulties that we're dealing with right now.
Ruth.
Well, I can't agree on that one, I'm afraid. The Russians and the French were undermining actively and publicly the mission of UNSCOM, the UN weapons inspection team that was trying to uproot Saddam's weapons of mass destruction. The Russians and the French were front and center of the Security Council starting in 1996, trying to basically batter and counter the efforts of first Rolf Acheus and then Richard Butler and then ultimately Hans Blix. So the idea that the French obstruction was going to go away if you were more dulcet and sweet-natured, I don't think holds water.
Well, let's take one that's a little bit closer to the point, and that is Turkey's refusal to provide access to its bases or to allow American forces to transit that country. It seemed at some point in the run-up to the war that the Turks might be persuaded to provide that kind of access, and what put them off may have been the kind of bullheadedness or the pit bull nature, as it's been called, of people like Donald Rumsfeld.
Well, people read that the Turkish situation different ways. It was a very bad break for us, no doubt. It was a young government. It was, for the first time, an Islamic government, feeling its oats, but not with a lot of experience in diplomacy. Some people speculate that some of the European countries went to the parliamentary opposition in Turkey and urged them not to deploy themselves in favor of American access to the northern bases. And it left the Pentagon and the government with a very different, difficult so-called workaround. How do you reconfigure your entire warfighting strategy if you're not going to have two fronts? It hurt us, no doubt. But I think that was a phenomenon of the change of government in Turkey and having to deal with a Turkey that has a turbulent politics because of its macroeconomic situation, because of the fact that the Europeans won't let them in. To put that as a matter of the stylistics of press conferences of Donald Rumsfeld, I think would be very reductionist.
Well, I don't think the issue would be just a style of press conferences, but it seems to me simply to write that off as a bad break is to be too kind. The Defense Department had nurtured relations with the Turkish military over a period of a half century, mm-hmm. and claimed to have enormous influence in Turkey. And it was, at least to the best of my understanding, DOD's responsibility to now translate that relationship into assistance in this war effort, and DOD failed. It was a blunder, and it was a blunder that had consequences not in particular in the way that the immediate campaign unfolded, but it seems to me had consequences in the way that the occupation took shape. And, of course, it's the occupation phase which has turned out to be problematic. For us to have been able to move the 4th Infantry Division through Turkey as the plan called for, seems to me, would have been an enormous benefit. And the Department of Defense, and specifically the leadership of the Department of Defense, blew it on that one.
Well, if I could just respond to that. I mean, DOD is in charge of their mill-mill relations. Unfortunately, this was the Turkish parliament, and young democracies are not always as compliant as one might wish them to be. I mean, Turkey's been a very interesting country strategically. It's been a friend of Israel. It's had, again, this difficult situation of whether to join Europe or to stay in the Middle East. But I don't think that there's any way that by UKs from across the river that you could tell a new government in Turkey how to manage its own parliament. It was a very bad event for us. Yes, I think it cost us militarily. I think it cost us in the occupation. It's a diplomatic problem. It's a military problem, but it's not something that could be controlled by one cabinet officer. And I don't think there's anything in the way that the Department of Defense was talking to the Turks that was off-putting in particular.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's take our first call now from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Rob's joining us. Hi, Rob.
Hi, thanks very much. I just wanted to address a comment Professor Wedgwood made a few moments ago in regard to the precipitous nature of much of the push coming from Rumsfeld and the Defense Department. It seemed that it was like a hysterical pregnancy, that there was a false sense of urgency, that whether there was a justification for going there or not, there was no justification for the urgency. And so much of what we're reaping now is a result of that, and how can that not be attributed to Secretary Rumsfeld?
Why is it not the president that we should be talking about in that case, Rob? Why is it Rumsfeld?
Well, I think the president was also had his own agenda and was eager to get going while he still had Blair on board. But I think that since the show's about Rumsfeld, think that a lot of the push was coming from Rumsfeld and Pearl and Wolfowitz. And it was like the red hen in reverse. They told us that there was a boogeyman that did not exist in that urgency, and they made us think that the alternative to attacking was nothing, and that also wasn't the case. And that's the extreme haste for an urgency that wasn't there is why we're where we are now.
All right,
and I just wondered what Professor Wedgwood would say about that.
Well, my first investment in Iraq was, if you like, supporting what was taken to be the almost less liberal project of UNSCOM, which was to see if you could disarm a country by a sanctions regime rather than by conquest in 1991. And the urgency was, shall we say, after a mere delay of 12 years, that the UNSCOM project, trying to get WMD out of Saddam's hands, had really come to the end of its ropes. It had been through three UNSCOM chairmen, and also a Brazilian named Amorim, who had done the same kind of analysis. Everyone had agreed that Saddam had not been willing to give any credible accounting of his material balances of VX nerve gas precursor, of chem and bio-adaptable warheads, of growth media for biological weapons. So really, if one didn't act then, the project would peter out, and you'd have to say, God bless, go in peace, and grow whatever weapons you'd like to grow. So if you were going to do this, you had to do it sometime in this time frame. The urgency was the following. Saddam wasn't cooperating at all with Hans Blix until we began to flow troops into the region again. And you can't keep 200,000 troops bivouacked in the desert, poised to strike for a period of a year and a half while the French decide that they're under control of the Security Council.
Okay, Rob, I hope that helps you with your question. 1-800-423-8255. Let's go next to Lincoln, Massachusetts. Sam's with us. Hi, Sam.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was listening to this conversation in my car and can't help but remember that it's September 10th. And on the day before September 11th, it's outrageous to me to be having this type of conversation, and I'll tell you what my point is right now, is that terrorism is not a state act. It's an act of individuals or a group of individuals. And I don't think Donald Rumsfeld or President Bush has the capacity to understand how to deal with individual acts of terrorism or a group of individuals acting as terrorism. And his linkage of Saddam Hussein and the state of Iraq to terrorist act, it was an abomination and an insult to everyone who died at the World Trade Center. And I feel like after the World Trade Center was taken out, I feel less safe than more safe, and I lay this right in the lap of President Bush. He does not have the capacity or the intent to understand terrorist acts and how to deal with them. And further...
So insofar as we're talking about his defense secretary here, are you saying this has nothing to do with Rumsfeld? This is all about whatever the president...
No. I think it has to do with Rumsfeld because he does not have the capacity either. He's a power politician. He doesn't understand people or human relationships. He just understands the rarefied atmosphere of states and power. That doesn't speak to terrorism. Terrorism are acts of people who feel disenfranchised by state and power politics. You're in opposite universes, and Rumsfeld doesn't understand this, and he'll never understand it, and George Bush doesn't understand it. And that's why, 2 years later, I feel less safe with people like them running the country, because they don't have a fundamental understanding of why someone would take two planes and crash them into the World Trade
Center. Okay, Sam, I want to turn to Andrew Bacevich on this.
Well, I mean, I was opposed to the war, and I think it was a huge mistake, but nonetheless, I think Sam is selling Donald Rumsfeld and the president short in his understanding of what they are attempting to do. I believe that from the outset, the real justification for this war in the minds of the architects was not in particular to liberate the Iraqi people and remove this dictator, but to set in motion a process which they believe ultimately will result in radical political change in the Middle East, thereby removing the environment or changing the environment which gives rise to terrorism. Certainly Condoleezza Rice has emphasized that to us lately, that that's the justification. I personally think that that's an unachievable strategy, that we're simply going to get ourselves in deeper and probably complicate the problem, but at least it's important to credit them with having a strategy that addresses the terrorist threat.
Ruth, do you agree with that?
Well, I don't think the White House thought that they were going to create a utopian vision of secular democracies like Switzerland.
I
do agree that I think that Iraq is a keystone to the region. It puts pressure on Syria to change. It puts pressure on the Saudis to change. It makes it easier, difficult though it still is, to have a peace process in Israel because the West Bank stops being a strategic area since the U.S. or a more friendly state is at its back. So I do think there is a geostrategic vision as well. And on your caller, the problem we had, I think, in the 90s was we did see terrorism only as the act of individuals and not of states, and didn't appreciate that having host countries like Sudan or like Afghanistan was deeply dangerous because it provided a kind of logistical capacity that individuals by themselves couldn't encompass. And North Korea, we've seen the dangers of proliferation. With Saddam, his indefatigability in remaining committed to a WMD program. And I think the argument can be made that we waited too long rather than didn't wait long enough because Saddam had lots of time to get ready for us coming. But clearly, if the UN wouldn't act against Saddam after a 12-year project, it meant nobody would ever become disarmed.
I wonder, though, if we can just take a look at where we are now and move things a bit ahead, because we had yesterday that hearing at Congress where Paul Wolfowitz was asked some very pointed questions by people on both sides of the aisle. I mean, it didn't appear to be just a partisan attack there. There was also the news story that came out yesterday that members of the National Guard and the Reserve were being told that they're going to have to serve a lot longer in Iraq, and the follow to that, that recruitment in both is being affected as a result of that. And Andrew, I'm just wondering whether or not you look at the way that the country is responding to what's happening in Iraq and see that there's going to be more pressure put on the defense secretary as a result of these and other factors.
Well, I think so. I mean, Ruth Wedgwood's very opening remark said something enormously important, and that is that wars lead to unforeseen consequences and complications. And I must say that those who were selling the war back before it began didn't tell us that. Now, one could say, we're supposed to know that. We, the American people, are supposed to know that. But the selling of the war was one that said, this is going to solve a problem. It didn't say it's going to solve a problem and create two more. The fact is it has created additional problems. Professor Wedgwood said that we couldn't keep 200,000 troops in the desert waiting for a war to begin, but we're going to end up keeping something like that number of troops in the desert engaged in trying to suppress an insurgency. And we don't know how long that's going to take, but by most estimates, it's probably going to take several years. So at a minimum, it seems to me, I would find fault with Mr. Rumsfeld in advancing a case for war as something that was going to make our lives simpler, safer, and easier, when in fact it simply has not done that. And I must say, I say that as someone who did not, before the war, see Saddam Hussein as posing a proximate threat to the security of this country.
Ruth Wedgwood, I want to hear from you on that, but I think just before we do, we should listen once again to a little bit of tape of Defense Secretary Rumsfeld. And this is just days after soldiers entered Baghdad, Rumsfeld responding to questions about specifically post-war planning.
What's happened here is we've seen people go from debating the war plan they haven't read and the number of troops and all of that. Now they're debating the form of the government, which no one's decided, and what the post-Saddam Hussein regime exercise, activity, organization ought to look like.
So, Ruth, why shouldn't a defense secretary take responsibility for some of those unforeseen circumstances? Isn't that why he has teams of planners and people, you know, giving advice to the Defense Department like you do?
Well, that's why you do have planners, and they have plans that are hypothetical, and they have plans that probably aren't going to apply. And every military guy will tell you that what their real stock and trade is learning to adapt the plans they have for things that occur that they did not foresee. Again, Saddam's tactic of fading away, you could know that it might happen, but what would you do about it in advance? You, again, could not import any great new capacity for counterinsurgency beyond what we have. We probably do need a new breed. I think actually Rumsfeld has spoken of this, of some kind of combination special forces intelligence folks. I think one of the greatest lessons from peacekeeping in the Balkans has been that we have to anticipate when we're going to be in an area for a while. And I always decried the fact that we didn't train up peacekeepers for the UN who were able to speak Serbo Croatian Bosnian so that they could engage in effective intelligence gathering and policing. And I do think it's important that we get smarter on languages in the armed forces if we're going to have missions in the region. But in the short run before a conflict, there's only so much you can do. And the Turkey card did require an incredible amount of last-minute maneuvering, which I think took a lot of people's attention.
Question for you, Connection listeners, about Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and whether or not he ought to be taking more heat, some of the responsibility for what's going wrong in a post-war Iraq. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. With me on the program today, Ruth Wedgwood. She's a professor of international law and diplomacy at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. Andrew Basevich is also with us. He's director of the Center for International Relations at Boston University. And Ruth, let me, if I can, turn to you, because we've been talking about unintended consequences or circumstances, and certainly the U.S. military didn't appear to be, prior to or in the days of the war, preparing for the nation-building work that they're involved in now or the counterinsurgency that they're involved in now. And I'm not sure why it is you don't look at that as somehow a failure of planning or a miss of the defense secretary.
Well, the circumstance, I think, that's been most irksome to Iraqi civilians is the lack of electricity. And that, in turn, has been made very difficult to remedy because of the lack of security and the kind of campaign of debilation where partisans are tearing down the grid as quickly as we can repair it. again, if you had anticipated that, what would you have done differently? Not done the war? If you were going to do the war, how would you provide greater electrical security? You can't have a sentry and a picket at every pylon and stanchion. What you have to hope to do is get enough local cooperation to figure out who is directing the attacks and to counter them. I guess it's kind of like the argument you make to lawyers, to juries in medical practice cases. Not every medical misevent is malpractice. Accidents happen, bad things happen, and you can't control all of them, even if you're doing what you should be doing as a physician.
But it seems to me that there could have been some things done. Again, had they shown a greater awareness of the prospect of post-Baghdad or post-victory, quote-unquote, operations. And since the administration emphasized the extent to which this war was the crucial stroke in its strategy for winning the war on terror, then why not mobilize significant combat formations from the reserve components in anticipation of that war? We do have some number of National Guard infantry brigades that have not been activated. To activate them would require a train-up period before they could be deployed, but had that been done in advance of this war, then we might not be able to guard every little component of the electrical grid, but we could come closer to saturating the country with a U.S. security presence and perhaps not have problems as great as we have today. That could have been done.
Let's let some of our callers back into Louisville, Kentucky now, and William's joining us. Hi, William.
Well, good morning. Looking at what was accomplished with this war, although the military victory was very swift and dramatic, it makes me think that perhaps very few real objectives were really accomplished. I mean, increasing the security of the United States, I don't feel more secure with half of our standing military standing on guard duty on street corners in Iraq. And I think our defense posture is weakened.
Is that Rumsfeld's fault, William?
Well, you know what? I blame him for not taking a strong position. I know Colin Powell took some positions against the administration during this, the warm-up, and then he buckled, I believe. But I think Rumsfeld went along with everybody. But I have to blame the whole administration for selling this, because we saw Condi Rice, Dick Cheney, Rumsfeld. We saw practically all the senior members of the administration out there pitching this thing like they're trying to sell a used car for months and months and months. But, you know, now we have to live with so many things. The Islamic world is very angry at us, as well as a big chunk of the non-Islamic world. I wish we had an internationalist president who understood where the roots of terror come from and how to address that. Which, you know, it's not that people hate America's freedoms. They're not hoping we will have less freedoms. They're mad at us for what they perceive as an arrogant approach to international politics and arbitrary redrawing of borders. And
you know, William, let me just stop you there for a minute and ask you not to go anywhere, because I want to take part of what you're saying and hear from first Andrew and then Ruth on it. And that is, you know, saying that despite what's going on in Iraq, nobody's feeling a whole lot safer. We know from what we hear and read about the fighting over there that the U.S. soldiers are being shot at and shooting back at Ba'ath Party people and Saddam loyalists. But what about, Andrew, the idea that if the point of the exercise was to reduce the threat of Islamic radicals, that's not what's happening in Iraq right now?
That's my judgment. I mean, I must say I feel safer than I did 2 years ago. I feel safer because it seems to me the administration has made a concerted effort, probably imperfect, to erect barriers of real homeland security. That's good. But I don't feel any safer because the regime of Saddam Hussein has been overthrown. That was not the epicenter of anti-American radicalism. That is not the wellspring from which Islamic radicalism is fed. And therefore, simply to overthrow Saddam Hussein doesn't get at the root of the problem. Indeed, I would argue, other people argue, it seems to me, that it has the unintended effect of perhaps exacerbating the problem, because it plays into the accusation, however unfair, that we are an imperial power, that we are an occupying power, that we are foreigners intent on imposing our values on people who are culturally different. And that is a very useful impression in the enemy camp.
Ruth, what about the idea that if all the billions spent in Iraq had been spent chasing down Osama bin Laden, concentrating in the search for al-Qaeda cells, that people like William might not have this sort of same sense of insecurity?
Well, let me just mention, I did a curious television debate on Lebanese television recently with Prince Turki of Saudi, who's the old Saudi intelligence chief, and now he's the ambassador to London. And my one question to him was, are you ever going to do anything about the Saudi funding for a kind of virulent Wahhabi propaganda where the Saudis are sending millions and millions of dollars all over the world to have a radical account of Islam displace the many moderate traditions of Islam in Central Asia and West Africa? And the prince curiously said basically that at least within the kingdom, they were calling the imams in for essentially training in pluralism, kind of a moderation lecture. That will be a great thing when the Saudis tuck tail and stop becoming.
Is he saying that's because of what's happened in Iraq, or is he saying that's because of what happened in Afghanistan?
I think in large part it's because of what happened in Iraq, that we're now right at their back door and they feel it. We couldn't really get tough with the Saudis so long as Saddam was there. We had to be in their kingdom to protect them against Saddam. Getting rid of Saddam means we don't have to be quite as close to Saudi Arabia anymore. On the roots of terror, are we ever the Gulliver giant? Of course. But the real fear now is that there is this civil war for the heart of Islam. And the roots of terror lie in this kind of philosophical choice. It's not poor people who are joining al-Qaeda. It's brats from middle-class and upper-middle-class families who think it's fun to be on jihad, or who have been beguiled and revived this kind of very dangerous, kiliastic movement. I take the point that, you know, George Bush could have given a Churchill speech about promising nothing but blood, sweat, and tears before we went into the war. I think everybody hoped the war would go differently. But that does not impugn the value of what was achieved.
William, back to you. I want to hear how you're hearing this.
Well, I feel that the big sales pitch for the war took advantage of the American public's belief that we can flatten any enemy in a matter of a few weeks, and that we never suspected that we would have an open-ended occupation involving so many people. With regard to terror and the roots of terror, although I'm certainly no expert on it, I'm just an average American citizen, I do know many people from the Middle East, and their memory goes back very, very far, farther than our country ever existed, as you probably know. But there are concerns about imperialism, there are concerns about autonomy. You know, there are countries in the Middle East where they've gone from one oppressive government to another, are based on a long history and a long knowledge. And for the United States has toppled democratic governments in the Middle East, Mossadegh in Iran in the early 50s. The United States has supported Israel, right or wrong, which has angered a lot of Arabic people because they know of the oppression and they see a well-fed Israeli kid with an American rifle standing over a impoverished Palestinian people.
And if I can just take this back to Ruth, some of those same people are now using the words shock and awe as a way of telling jokes about what the Americans said they would promise and what they delivered.
Well, I don't think anybody ever thought this was going to be an easy war. I think, in fact, there was great surprise going in that we didn't suffer. At least I was surprised. I was delighted, but surprised that we didn't suffer significant casualties from chemical counterattacks by Saddam. No, this was not going to be a walk-around. What Rumsfeld has done with the armed forces is to encourage them to be more mobile, more agile, to try to get places faster, to not simply have the big mass slowly moving down the European battlefield, which was the battle plan for the Soviets, but rather to take advantage of technology and information and agility. And that, I think, worked well both in Afghanistan and in Iraq. But still, there were great dangers in the war. If you like, this is a backloaded problem, to be sure. The dangers are occurring in the occupation, not the war, but nobody expected it was going to be a rose garden.
And when people talk about the Secretary of Defense years from now, Andrew, do you think it will be his ideas for transforming the military, his ideas for cutting back the large bases in Germany and South Korea and this sort of more mobile way of fighting that people will look at instead of the details of this war and the circumstances that the United States is in right now?
He didn't invent those ideas. Those ideas were in play throughout the 1990s and were cited by Clinton administration officials to become more mobile, more flexible. And so it seems to me that in that regard, with regard to the transformation of the U.S. military, he is one player in a rather long-standing drama that will continue to play itself out. His reputation, however, it seems to me, is going to rest on how the rest of this war unfolds. And if indeed Iraq turns out to be a quagmire, and I'm not predicting it will, but it could, then all the apparent brilliance of Afghanistan and the apparent brilliance of the march to Baghdad won't count for all that much in the history books.
Ruth, if I'm quoting Mr. Rumsfeld correctly, I think he said, "I don't do quagmires." And I know you spend time with a lot of people at or near the Defense Department. What are you hearing there from other people who provide this sort of advice? Are people saying, well, maybe this didn't work as well as we'd all thought it might?
Well, you get two reactions. One is people who say, "We told you so. You should have let us put Chalabi in place." That you had a guy who did know a lot of people who was prepared to try to organize a very quick Iraqi-based interim administration, and there was infighting between Pentagon and the State Department over what Chalabi's role should be, and ultimately the State Department won, and you had this much slower transition to the Iraqi Governing Council. I think having Sergio Vardamilla there was a very useful complement to Paul Bremer, because Sergio had been through Timor, where there was something of the same Stations of the Cross, where initially the UN thought it would take a long time to hand over power, and then José Ramos Horta said, "Hurry up, we're ready, don't condescend to us." And very quickly Sergio plugged in Timorese administrators, and I think having Sergio's advice there, I think, allowed Jerry Bremer to back and fill. Quagmire's nation building, the kind of indefinite, indeterminate static deployment of troops who are designed for combat is not attractive to anybody. But again, Saddam was Saddam, like Bin Laden, for all the fact that he's a nasty guy, is quite bright. And the idea of fading away and then trying to test our endurance is one that made a great deal of sense psychologically. In a sense, we are now in the throes of his assessment of what our staying power is. And I think when Rumsfeld...
Ruth, I have to let you go. We're out of time. Thanks for being with us.
Pleasure.
Ruth Redgewood is a professor of international law and diplomacy at Johns Hopkins. Andrew Bacevich, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you.
Andrew's director of the Center for International Relations at Boston University. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. ¶¶